From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield.
Do you believe that judges ever change the law?
What is the settled law in America about abortion?
How is it appropriate for a judge to say they will choose to see some facts and not others?
Does a state legislature have the right under the Constitution to determine what is death?
Just a few of the pointed questions this week from the Senate Judiciary Committee's confirmation hearings for President Obama's distressingly empathetic Supreme Court nominee, Sonia Sotomayor. Some on the committee, it became clear, were troubled by the revelation that judges are not, strictly speaking, automatons and could let their annoying, you know, humanity inform legal thinking. As for the nominee, Slate senior editor Dahlia Lithwick says the hearing served as an elaborate calculus of 19 different ways to answer a question at length without saying anything.
You can say the question is too broad, so you can't answer it. You can say the question is too specific, so you can't answer it. You can say that was so far in the past, I can't talk about it. Or it's so far in the future, I can't talk about it. And so on. You know, there's this whole formulation of how you don't answer questions. So why we spend 4 days watching this with bated breath is actually the better question.
And in fact, I want to go back to the confirmation hearings of Justices Samuel Alito and John Roberts. During those hearings, both the nominees were at pains to deny an ideological tilt. And as we have seen from Alito's and Roberts' totally predictable, totally lockstep voting records, their testimony at the time was preposterous. And, you know, I think equally preposterous when Sotomayor denies being in any way ideologically inflected. At some point, isn't this testimony just lying?
John Roberts put into popular parlance the umpire analogy. He said, this is what great judges do. They just call balls and strikes. And within 4 seconds, people were saying, wait, umpires don't just call balls and strikes. They set the strike zone. But we're still living under the burden of that analogy. And in fact, everybody knows that to be patently false. I mean, we all know the one thing we can all agree on is that if there were one mechanical application of the law, we would only need one judge, and it could be a supercomputer. It wouldn't even need to be a judge. So clearly, experience matters, your history matters, your ideology, your politics, your beliefs matter. Obama had worked out this very elaborate empathy test. He said, this is what we want in a judge. We don't want an umpire who calls balls and strikes. We want someone with empathy. And she went out of her way to chuck it quite publicly and to say, that's not what I do. That's not what judges should do. Judges just apply the law.
I don't need your stinking empathy.
Exactly. So to the extent that progressives had hoped that she was going to sit there and articulate the Scalia-like liberal vision of jurisprudence to explain to us what she was going to bring to the court that was beyond calling balls and strikes, she certainly did not do that this week.
You know, it just occurred to me that in using that line, I'm quoting Eli Wallach, who was playing a Mexican bandito when he said, I don't need your stinking badges. And I have pulled exactly what Senator Tom Coburn did when he did his Ricky Ricardo impression.
If I go home, get a gun, come back and shoot you, that may not be legal under New York law because you would have alternative ways.
You'll have lots
defend.
Of explaining to do.
What's going on here with the senator and with me?
We're all so busy not talking about race that we're thinking about race. I mean, what this whole hearing was a public referendum on race in America and how you balance diversity with equality and how you balance a colorblind constitution with a constitution that affirmatively seeks to make reparations to certain races. These are hard questions, and we're not talking about them, but we're all thinking about them. So I'll give you the benefit of the Freudian doubt on this one. It's really complicated, and we're not moving forward. I think we're moving sideways.
With the so-called litmus test issues approached only so obliquely, and with the nominee demurring on, you know, any question of substance, has the Senate's advise and consent role been obliterated here? Are we now just talking about a media spectacle, an opportunity for political posturing and showboating?
Well, I think there's two different interpretations of what that role is. Lindsey Graham went out of his way to say, look, president won the election. He gets to pick his people. We have to abide by that. The lesson here is win elections. There are other senators who really, really felt that it was absolutely impossible for them to vote for her unless they knew her exact answer to what is the test for whether a gun right is fundamental under the Second Amendment. So I think there's a disparity, even among the senators, about what the contours of that advise and consent role is. That said, this is a spectacle in which we learn a lot about the parties. I think we learn a lot about what constituents are telling Senator Tom Coburn when they call him on the phone, what they're worried about. And so to that extent, I think it's a useful exercise. The nominee has nothing to do with that. She could be like a ficus potted in the corner. But to see these people play out these very, very profound questions about how can you be proud of your race and not be some kind of essentialist racist, those are interesting questions. And I don't think we talked about it particularly well in this hearing, but watching those anxieties and how they're voiced and how they're telegraphed, I think that's a spectacle that's at least interesting and probably at some level better than not having this conversation at all.
All right. Dahlia, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate, where she covers legal issues. Not long into the life of the super ultra transparent Obama administration, the Washington Press Corps found itself wondering if the White House knows the difference between transparent and invisible. So much basic official information had come offered only in so-called background briefings, in which no actual official puts his or her name on the line, that the press screamed foul. Led by Associated Press correspondent Jennifer Lovin, who's also president of the White House Correspondents Association, reporters demanded that officials stop sounding like a broken off-the-record. Lovin's boss, the AP's Michael Oreskes, says that background briefings make it impossible for the public to evaluate the information.
Do you know where it came from? Do you know what the motive of the person who gave it to you is? Do you know what their reliability is? And the background briefing undercuts all of that. It makes it harder to tell where the information's coming from and what the motives of the source are. Jennifer and her colleagues felt there was a time here to draw a line early in the administration and to say, you shouldn't just use this because you felt like it or because you could.
I can see how these background briefings began. It seems to me that it goes back to a diplomatic problem where a Secretary of State would want to be frank and candid, but for international diplomacy reasons, simply could not. And therefore, the Secretary of State became a, you know, highly placed State Department official.
The most famous example of that, Bob, was the senior official traveling aboard Secretary Kissinger's plane, who every journalist in Washington knew was Secretary Kissinger. But somehow we had agreed not to reveal who it really was.
Exactly. But as silly as that may seem, in recent weeks, the situation has gotten absurd.
The situation's become a parody of itself in a number of cases. We've had briefings, for example, on the administration's plans for the auto industry. They insisted it be on background. We went ahead and allowed it to be on background. They got up from these briefings on the auto industry and went out on cable TV and said the same thing. We're not asking them to eliminate every background briefing on every possible subject. We're just suggesting that there are many of these background briefings that simply don't need to be on background.
When is it warranted to accept on background only?
Well, I wouldn't set a hard and fast rule. There certainly are cases, as you described, where perhaps a diplomatically delicate situation justifies it. There may be cases where national security requires it for some reason or other. It's clearly not the case when a background briefing is simply giving an administration position that the administration then repeats in other ways in other forums. That's clearly not serving anybody.
Okay, so I'm a reader of the Daily Bugle, and I'm reading a story from the AP about a White House briefing. I see senior administration official. I don't see the actual name. What do I care? The information's there, right?
I think it's something President Obama himself has said. We live in an age where people need to take more responsibility, and we want the people who give us the information to be responsible for that information. And background briefings undercut responsibility. People say things without being responsible for them, and we think that's a mistake.
So it strikes me that there's a simple solution to this problem, and that is for the White House Press Corps to get some backbone And the next time someone in the administration tries this, to simply say, no, we will not take this on background. And, oh, by the way, we are going to report the attempt to take official information on background and continue to do that until you start talking to us on the record the way you're supposed to.
Our Washington bureau chief, Ron Fournier, has been talking very closely with some of his colleagues, the other bureau chiefs for major news organizations here in Washington, and they in turn have been talking to the White House about what the next steps are going to be. We're hoping to negotiate a reasonable set of ground rules for briefings by the White House, which puts many more of them on the record, while still respecting those rare occasions when the White House might have a real need to put something on background. The tone of the discussions with the White House has been very good. We've been quite frank and honest with each other. So we're pressing the issue now, and we will press forward with it. So stay tuned, as you would say in radio.
All right, I'll stay tuned. But what I've been tuning into mostly is the comments that I've been reading, which get to the point that, well, no, we can't walk out on these sessions because we don't want to be the one news organization that doesn't get the information that's being presented on background. You know, the argument being, what can we do? It's a seller's market.
It's a seller's market only as long as we're ready to buy. We are working to come up with a unified approach so that no one news organization will feel like they're walking out and being left in the lurch by others who decide to go in and get the information.
Has any previous press corps ganged up and said, this will not stand?
Yeah, we had this very same argument with the Bush administration, and actually for a while made some progress, I thought, and then slipped back again. You try to renegotiate the relationship with each new administration, so I think part of what we're going through here is starting over with a fresh team and a new crew and hoping we can draw the line in a place that's satisfactory to everybody.
Well, that's very grown up of you, and I appreciate the spirit of cooperation. But at some point, do you stop negotiating and just say no?
We may have to. If we have to, we have to. But we'll cross that Rubicon when we get to it.
All right. Mike, thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Bob.
Mike Oreskes is Senior Managing Editor at the Associated Press. Coming up, online ads that can track your every move and print ads you can eat. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. There are basically three ways to be advertised to online. One is willy-nilly. The space is dirt cheap, and advertisers buy it by the ton to show everybody the same dancing silhouettes or whatever. Then there is search. You type in a search term, and advertisers who have bought certain keywords get their text ads returned to you in the paid results section. The unique capabilities of online advertising, however, really show up in behaviorally targeted ads, which pay attention to where you've visited online to deduce which ads might most interest you. That has some advantages to the user. Relevant ads are pretty much the opposite of unwanted spam, and targeted ads fetch more for the publishers, which means better content for you. But doesn't it also mean that advertisers are snooping creepily into your online life, following you as you search health information, put your resume up on Monster, and your credit card info down for porn? To address privacy concerns, the Interactive Advertising Bureau and four other marketing trade groups have released a proposal for industry self-regulation. But the first thing President and CEO Randall Rothenberg wants you to know is that nobody is tracking you personally, nor is anyone even tracking your computer's IP address.
It is a technological marker called a cookie inside a browser application that is being targeted. There's no way for a server, which is the technology on the other end, to know that you are Bob Garfield or even have any sense of what a Garfield might be.
In fairness,
More and more, privacy has, in our society, become a commodity. Travelers exchange it for safety, celebrities exchange it for celebrity, and you and I exchange it for a few cents off at the checkout aisle and the Safeway. And by the way, the Safeway does know our names and addresses. So why, when the subject comes to internet behavior, does it become so volatile?
I think people have a justifiable, legitimate concern about black boxes. We know that the internet is, by definition, interactive, that it takes information about what I'm typing in order to send things to me. But the average human being has no idea how that sausage making takes place in the wires and chips and ether that is the internet. And I think in that unknown, there's, you know, disquiet, and that lends itself quite legitimately to concern.
If your industry, if it understands to a moral certainty that people are queasy about that which they do not understand, why in the world are they behaving so defensively by promoting a kind of self-regulatory apparatus that in the traditional advertising industry is toothless and ridiculously slow and exists, as far as I'm concerned, only to keep actual regulators off the backs of the industry? So why aren't you being, you know, proactive in meeting the queasiness halfway?
Bob, we were proactive. This is perhaps the first time in the history of the advertising industry where associations representing the entire ecosystem got together without there being a crisis. There is no public outcry here. No significant move afoot in Congress.
But there has been a move in Congress. The House Commerce Committee got into this issue over a company called NebuAd and have promised to pay still more attention once some other more critical issues of the Democrats' agenda are taken care of. They have announced attention to be very vigilant on this subject.
It is an issue. It is not a crisis. The industry has done absolutely the right thing by getting ahead of this curve and saying, you know what, if there is any disquiet here, we have to be able to rectify the mistakes I think the industry did make over a 10-year period, really beginning in 1999. The industry has done nothing concerted or coordinated to address the public or to address, certainly to address legislators or regulators about the sausage making of the internet. I mean, one of the principles that we're now going to embed in a self-regulatory system, we're committing the entire marketing ecosystem to educating the public continuously about both benefits and risks and risk mitigation.
All right. So one of the issues is whether consumers should be able to opt out of targeting that they regard as too invasive, or whether they should be required to opt in to the placement of cookies and the tracking of cookies on their hard drives. Now, the publishers go nuts at the idea of having them opt in because they believe almost nobody will, not understanding what they're losing and not understanding the economic impact. I suggest a middle path. What if there were, on every commercial site, a fader that allows you to adjust for this particular application what degree of privacy you are comfortable with? And that way, everybody can judge for themselves just how exposed they wish to be.
Well, why not an alternative? Why not make everybody subscribe by name to everything they want to get on the internet?
Because it's impractical.
Thank you.
But it's not the same thing.
Hey, I mean, asking people to move a slider on every site when they're zipping around the internet to say, okay, over here I want it at 10 degrees, over here I run it at 15 degrees, is far more impractical, I think, than asking people to subscribe to everything. And the answer in both cases, other than impracticality, I think is the same. People need to understand that all the seemingly free information they get, all the seemingly free email accounts, each of those comes because of advertising supporting those sites. If you're asking people to move sliders back and forth, you're pretty dramatically changing the advertising support equation that's kind of the backbone of the value proposition in American media. I mean, if you want to talk about regulating IP addresses, that will mean that stuff will not get through to you. Not just ads, but your customized homepage. The best way to make them understand is not to threaten them or scare them. It's to explain to them where the value comes from.
All right. Randy, thank you very much.
Robert, always a pleasure.
Randall Rothenberg is the president and CEO of the Interactive Advertising Bureau. Online advertising is the holy grail for news organizations looking to replace all that revenue they've lost from classified subscriptions and print advertising. But there's one thing you can do with a print ad that you will never be able to do with an online pop-up. Eat it. That's right. A New Jersey marketing company, US Inc., has begun inserting paper strips called Taste and Save sticky notes into print advertisements for food products. Todd Wheeler is marketing manager for US Inc., and he says that putting that strip in your mouth is the next best thing to eating the food itself.
They use an edible film, very similar to the ubiquitous Listerine strip. And what they're able to do is replicate the taste of any food or beverage. It's never been offered before where you have taste sampling for an advertising experience to a mass market.
You mean taste sampling like in the supermarket where the lady stops you and gives you some sort of cheese puff?
That's right. Using that method can be somewhat costly, and you know, for a given store, you may interface with 200, 300 people per store per day. By using the newspaper mass media, you're able to hit tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in one day. You know, it's interesting, a lot of times we hear about the death of newspapers, but more than 100 million adults in the United States read a printed newspaper every day. That's more than watch the Super Bowl.
Okay, so we're talking about publishing and food strip technology, but of course the first thing that jumps to my mind is the painting by Magritte of a pipe, and the painting I think is titled, "This is not a pipe, this is a picture of a pipe." When you have a flavor strip that tastes like a can of stewed tomatoes but is really just a flavor strip of a can of stewed tomatoes, isn't that almost false advertising?
Not really. Let me explain by giving you a real-life example. First Flavor worked with Welch's, and they did an ad in People magazine. After the ad ran and they used the peel and taste technology, they found out that 29% of the readers of the magazine actually tried the flavor strip, which roughly translates to 1.5 million consumers sampling the taste of Welch's. Perhaps more importantly, 59% of the flavor strip triers were more likely to purchase the Welch's brand of grape juice.
All right, final question. Is there any nutritional content to the strips? And then B, could a newspaper actually double as a meal?
The flavor strips have zero calories. And again, the ingredients are all FDA approved.
All right. Well, Todd, thank you so very much.
Bob, thank you.
Todd Wheeler is marketing manager of US Inc. Almost 15 years ago, in the midst of his mother's health crisis, Washington Post editor Steve Luxenberg learned something surprising. His mom had had a sister who'd been institutionalized and lost track of as a child. How could he not have known this? Well, for one reason, because his mother had kept the secret for decades. For another, it wasn't entirely true. Subsequently, the journalist Luxenberg would begin pulling the threads on a family secret, whereupon his notion of family history began to unravel. The story is told in Luxenberg's new book, Annie's Ghost. Luxenberg recalls the first moment when journalistic curiosity required fact-checking his own loved ones.
In 1995, my mom was being interviewed by a psychiatrist, and she was asked her routine family history and said she had a disabled sister who had gone away to an institution when she was 4 and her sister was 2, and she had no idea what happened to this sister. We didn't ask her about it in our family because she was quite ill, and we thought that there wouldn't be any point. 5 years later, after her death, We got a letter from a cemetery asking us if we'd like to plant flowers on our grandparents' graves, but instead of listing two graves, it listed three, and now the secret had a name, Annie.
So now you know that this reference your mother made in the midst of psychiatric extremis was a living, breathing aunt of yours. What did you do?
I believe what my mom had said, that she didn't know what had happened to her sister. So I didn't pursue it then, and then after I heard that she had buried her sister, that is, I called the cemetery and learned that my mom had arranged the burial, well, the first myth kind of exploded. If she buried her sister, then she obviously knew what happened to her. So now the journalist kicked in, overwhelming the son, I suppose, and I made a call to Lansing, Michigan, to talk to somebody in the Department of Community Health. I reached a woman, and I asked her, I've just learned about my aunt. I'd like to know something about her. I think she was in the mental hospital. And she said, you and 5,000 other people. But one of the more important things that I had learned, I'd gotten some records that weren't easy to ferret out. And when I looked at them, instead of seeing that my mom had been 4 years old and her sister was two, my mom had been 23 and her sister 21. So they had grown up together, and this changed, again, my perception of my mom.
This book is a number of things. One is a journey into your family's secrets, and another is a journey into the history of treatment of Americans with physical disorders, mental disorders, and psychiatric ones. And I guess even though on the face of it, your aunt's experience at Eloise must have been horrifying, it was way better than what someone like her might have been getting elsewhere in America at exactly that time.
Well, you know, her time in the mental institution from a writer's point of view is ideal because she straddles two very different eras. The peak of one, which was the time when states kind of considered that they owed treatment and care to its mentally ill, and the period of the emptying out of these huge institutions. One of the more fascinating things that I learned was that, you know, every generation thinks that it is doing better than the last in terms of taking care of the mentally ill or the physically disabled, and that generation was no different. In 1949, a Portuguese scientist was awarded the Nobel Prize for the development of the lobotomy. That's what that generation thought of that procedure, and of course now we consider it to be barbaric.
The history of American, what they used to call asylums, also has a kind of a dual function in your book. It enables us as readers to see in context the treatment given your aunt, but it also puts in context your own family's conduct with respect to her and the decision when she was a young woman to institutionalize her, because I guess there was a kind of a last straw moment when they were very impoverished and your aunt's psychiatric condition was worsening and she was literally keeping the entire household awake every night. I guess they simply could not stand the pressure anymore. Is that a fair summation?
The term that was in the report was, we're all going crazy. Annie was exhibiting extreme paranoia, refusing to eat, bathe, wouldn't leave the house for a week at a time. If she did leave the house, occasionally she would stand on the curb and refuse to cross the street. And they didn't have many choices. Their poverty meant that they couldn't get private treatment for Annie, and there weren't very many treatments anyway. Today she would have been treated at a much earlier age. She had a whole host of problems when she was born with a deformed leg. Finally, her leg was amputated. And then the paranoia began to exhibit itself around 18 or 19.
I want to ask you about conflict. The moment that made me gasp in reading this book was when it occurred to you, and you essentially said aloud, the possibility that your parents were married not necessarily because they were so in love, but you leave open the possibility that your father was just looking for a family in order to get a deferment from World War II. Do you have to bite your lip to go there?
I felt that I had to disclose that there was a reason why my mother would have met my father in June of 1942 and that they would be married so quickly. By November, they were married. Was it really love at first sight? My mother was desperately in love with him. I think that they truly were in love, in fact. But being in love and getting married so quickly wasn't the same thing. And it wasn't biting my lips so much as being candid as I felt I needed to be to earn the reader's respect so that when I finished the book, they could say, well, I can give the guy an opportunity to say what he thinks really happened here, because I have to lead to some conclusion about what I think my mother's reasons were for keeping the secret. And I didn't really want to pull any punches.
So there were the circumstances of your parents' marriage. There was the secret of your aunt. And then there was your description of your father's military career, which was, shall we say, undistinguished. Did you get any grief from your siblings? How much support did you have from them as you were digging deeper and deeper into the family's private saga?
I got quite a lot of support, but it was episodic and uneven. I mean, my sister, who is actually my dad's daughter by a first marriage and not my mom's daughter, she was gung-ho. My younger brother, gung-ho a little bit less, but still pretty interested. My older brother was unwilling to think that I could really get to where I wanted to go. But you have to remember, my family was one that didn't believe that the past mattered. As I write in the book, the past wasn't just past, it was irrelevant. We were a modern American family. We were going to overcome all those injustices that our European ancestors, Jewish ancestors, had suffered. We were going to make something of ourselves. And so I think that he was just, why are you going back into the past? Why are you doing this? But in the end, he's been very supportive. There's no tension in the family over the book. But I just think we don't see the world quite the same way, and that's why I'm a journalist and he was a contracts negotiator.
Steve, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Steve Luxenberg is an associate editor of The Washington Post and author of Annie's Ghosts, A Journey into a Family Secret. Coming up, some extremely unappetizing stories about food. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John Dee and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And now for some letters. We had hundreds of responses to my interview with NPR Ombudsman Alicia Shepard on the subject of using the word torture to describe waterboarding. The nearly universal sentiment was outrage at a news organization's embracing of the Bush administration euphemism, enhanced interrogation techniques. But the vast majority of commenters attribute NPR's policy not to excess caution, but to collaboration, conspiracy, and/or cowardice. This comment from Al Gomez was typical. Once again, the mask slips to reveal the hidden hand at work. National Pentagon Radio says it all. On a less inflammatory matter, Howard Rowe wrote, "On the segment of your program last weekend that dealt with NASA and the media, you stated that John Glenn was the, quote, first human being to orbit the Earth. Wrong. That honor went to Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin. Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth. Later, in the segment on Nikita Khrushchev's tour of the U.S., you identified the Iowa farmer who hosted Khrushchev as Randall Garst. Wrong again. His name was Roswell Garst." Yes, Mr. Rowe, I got both of those things wrong, but why single out those errors? I also pronounced China's ethnic Uyghurs as Uyghurs and misidentified the first Eisenhower-Khrushchev summit as the first U.S.-Soviet summit. Oy, sorry. If you locate other screw-ups or just want to share, you can do so by commenting at WNYC.org or email us at onthemedia@WNYC.org. Big tobacco, big pharma, weapons manufacturers, they're all industries notorious for stonewalling journalists and for intimidating potential sources from talking to the press. But what about big food? Filmmaker Robert Kenner didn't expect that doing a documentary on agribusiness would be that difficult, but he says that making his documentary Food, Inc. required more legal fees than his past 15 films combined. Kenner joins me now. Robbie, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be here, Bob. Thanks.
You have described the process of making this film about agribusiness as Orwellian. What did you expect when you set out to make this film?
Well, I actually thought we would be having a conversation with the people who are producing our food. I realize that we might not be welcomed into slaughterhouses with open arms, but I did think that people would be able to sort of talk with us. I think I could have had greater access if we were doing a film on nuclear terrorism than if we were doing a film on food. I didn't realize what a subversive subject this turned out to be. I was surprised by it.
Well, since you brought up subversion, I should say that I'm looking at your filmography, and I don't see any, you know, immediately evident ideological tilt.
You know, I don't think of myself as an ideological filmmaker. My last film before this was told from multiple points of view, and I found myself becoming totally sympathetic to viewpoints that were very different than mine. And I sort of was open to that on this film, but it turned out to be very different. There were occasional cracks. Richard Lobb from the National Chicken Council came and talked with us, and we used one little piece of his, which is, we produce more chickens on less land for fewer dollars. What's wrong with that? And, you know, I thought that's a valid viewpoint, and I wanted to present their best viewpoint. Unfortunately, he was one of the very few people who would talk to us.
Well, as to what is wrong with that, what's the bill of indictment?
Well, I think that the food we eat is really very different than it was 40, 50 years ago. Most of agribusiness is not interested in us looking behind the veil. For me, one of the more shocking things was we went to a hearing on whether we should be labeling cloned meat. And the representative from the meat industry said,
"The reason that we are concerned with labeling is it creates unnecessary fear in consumers' mind until the industry has an opportunity to educate why we want to use this technology and the value of the technology. We don't feel that consumers just having a warning label will help them."
I found it really upsetting to be told that it's too confusing to be given this kind of information. And I always thought, in a free market, you need to have access to information to make decisions. And we're being denied that information. And the industry keeps saying these things are good, but they'll do everything possible to not let you get the information that it's in the food you're eating. They'll actually even sue producers who put on their labels that their food does not contain that. And it goes beyond that. In talking to one of the people in the film, a woman named Barb Kowalczyk, whose son died from eating a hamburger with E. coli, at the end of the interview, I asked her how it affects how she eats.
Yeah, you probably have to talk to an attorney before you would put this in there.
Well, you could say this is, you know, we've stopped,
yeah. I know, but I could have the meat and poultry industry coming after me, and I really...
Seriously, for saying...
But I get asked this all the time,
really?
And...
It's pretty amazing that you can't say how you and your family
Well, the veggie libel laws are different.
She said, "Don't you remember Oprah?" And then all of a sudden, I vaguely remembered that Oprah had been sued for saying during the mad cow disease, it makes you think twice about eating a hamburger. And she was sued for disparaging a food product and a potential loss of income.
I'm laughing. It's so not funny. But please explain the whole idea of disparaging a food product.
Well, there are now laws that if you endanger the profits of a food corporation, you can be sued. And Oprah spent 6 years in court, over $1 million, and she eventually won her case. But it's very difficult for people in this world to sort of start to question things. And if I had been aware of how litigious this world was before I began, I might have had second thoughts.
I'm curious whether the defensiveness and the stonewalling and at least the implicit threat of litigation changed the thrust of your film.
Well, I found the more I was being rejected, the more I wanted to sort of made me very angry, but it also kept me up at night and made me scared. Right now, there's another film that there's an injunction against it. Luckily, we did not have an injunction against our film.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is whether the industry's stonewalling actually backfired on them, whether the film is much harsher for you having been forced to do without their comments.
Well, I think that's the case because there are a few companies that actually come into this film. And one of them, at the very last second after 2 years, was Walmart. And they are shown in probably one of the more positive lights that you will ever see Walmart. They had been approached by numbers of their consumers who did not want milk with the RBST, with the growth hormone in it. And when we went to film with them, they announced that they were no longer going to buy milk with RBST. Soon after they made that announcement, Monsanto ended up selling the company that produced RBST. So I was so sort of anxious to show that we were going to treat a corporation very fairly that was wanting to be somewhat transparent and sort of come to the table and talk.
Did you end up pulling some punches, you know, in anticipation of litigation?
There are things that I pulled out that I think were true. I'm used to working with high levels of fact-checking. I've worked with National Geographic and worked with American Experience. But on this film, we spent a lot of time and looked for multiple sources. And there were times where our lawyers would make us redo things. One example was that we were dealing with chicken farmers who were involved with Tyson and Perdue, who I think are very big in the Southeast. And one chicken farmer said that she was giving arsenic to her chickens. And Perdue said, well, we've stopped that practice. But they had defended the practice of giving arsenic to chickens a few weeks prior to our filming with the chicken farmer. I ended up taking that out of the film. But the fact is, they were like defending that just a mere few weeks before. But I felt, you know, we'll take it out.
Why were they giving arsenic to chickens?
Because it kills the bacteria and it helps them grow quicker. But the fact that it's getting into the water and the land and into the food we're eating is besides the point. And if they can keep it off the label, they find customers were still buying it.
The chicken farmer who was giving her broilers arsenic under contract with Perdue, having acknowledged that to your cameras, is she still a Perdue contractor?
She is no longer in the industry. If you speak out against this industry, you do so at great peril. And that's what happened to this lady. She knew basically what the consequences would be, but she just could not live with herself any longer. I should say that we tried approaching dozens and dozens and dozens of other chicken farmers, most of whom would have liked to have talked to us, but they realized the consequences of talking and they ultimately would not go on camera.
All right, Robbie. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Robert Kenner, producer and director of Food, Inc., joins a long tradition of exposing unpleasant truths about the food industry. You can trace that tradition at least as far back as 1906, when Upton Sinclair published his most famous book. Historian Kevin Madsen joins us to talk about that staple of the middle school canon. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So tell me about the most famous work of Upton Sinclair.
Well, that would be The Jungle, a book that is all about muckraking, but it's also a novel, which makes it rather interesting because Sinclair is trying to write a novel about the meatpacking industry and about the people who work in the meatpacking industry. And along the way, he hits upon the way meat is prepared for Americans' consumption. And in that process, he tells some pretty horrific stories about rats dying on piles of meat and poison being thrown out to kill the rats and being pushed into hoppers and coming out the other side. And that's what is winding up on Americans' breakfast tables.
Rejected European sausage being thrown right back into the sausage hopper. A lot of horrifying details.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. That wasn't Sinclair's intention. What he really wanted to try to focus on, because he was a socialist, was the exploitation of the workers in packing town and in the meatpacking plants. But as he once famously said, he aimed for the hearts of Americans and he hit them right in their stomachs.
Unintended consequences, but consequences nonetheless.
Exactly.
The publication of The Jungle, fiction though it was nonetheless an expose, and it resulted in the first sweeping legislation that concerned food safety.
That's right. The Meat Inspection Act follows the novel's publication. It's dangerous to say that the novel caused the legislation to actually become reality. But it's important to back up just a bit. This is at a period of time in American literary history when realism is very important. And so for the novel, what Sinclair decided to do was to do some firsthand research into the meatpacking industry. So he went to Chicago, moved there for a number of weeks. He disguised himself as a worker, putting on a hat and bringing a little lunch pail into the meatpacking plants. So he had a whole host of notes about what he had seen in the meatpacking plants. And his claim was that everything he said in the jungle did in fact happen. And when Teddy Roosevelt learned of the jungle and thought that something needed to be done about what Sinclair had written about, he demanded that Sinclair visit him in the White House. And he asked him, essentially, did you make this stuff up? Is what's in the jungle reality? And Sinclair said, oh, absolutely. You can send your people down there and they can investigate it for themselves and you'll find out I told the truth. Roosevelt sends some men down there and they come back and they say, yep, looks like Sinclair pretty much told the truth. He might have even downplayed a few of the details.
Now, about 80 years later, when ABC News went into a food lion to document unsanitary practices in their butchers' departments, they got into a whole mess of trouble for essentially for misrepresenting themselves in order to become employees of Food Lion. Upton Sinclair didn't get in any trouble with the law, did he?
No, but he was worried that he would be attacked by the meat industry and that they would become very defensive. I think that they didn't go after him with as heavy a guns as they possibly could, in part because there was just this general fear that, for the most part, they thought that Sinclair was pretty accurate in his descriptions. And secondly, if they attacked him any more and went after him with their big legal honchos, they might actually gain more attention for the novel than they really wish.
Not to mention a change of consumer behavior on a grand scale. The jungle actually persuaded people to eat a whole lot less meat, I guess, for a generation.
Yeah, that's right. You could see declines in meat sales once the jungle came out. Again, you can't necessarily draw direct correlations, but there's no doubt in most people's minds that the two had something to do with one another. When you read the parts of that novel in which you're hearing about human beings falling into vats and then that becoming a part of the meat that people are eating at the breakfast table, it's not really great inspiration to go out there and buy yourself a new thing of sausage. So no doubt it actually was something that created probably a downhill slide for the meat industry in general. Sinclair himself actually was a vegetarian for a while, experimented with a lot of different and somewhat bizarre diets over the course of the years that followed from the jungle.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because in many ways, Upton Sinclair was quite the eccentric. In fact, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, a world-class weirdo, but a very prolific one. He wrote dozens of books, I think more than 90 books
yeah.
and tracts and plays and what have you, and wound up eventually running for the governorship of California. Tell me a little bit about that race.
When he ran for governor in 1934, at that point in time, the Los Angeles Times was a conservative newspaper. And one of the things that the paper did on a regular basis was to go back to some of Sinclair's incendiary works, particularly those that dealt with issues pertaining to religion and to his belief in free love. And they essentially just took parts of his writings and parts of his tracts and reprinted them on the front page of the newspaper to basically say, look, this is the guy you're going to be voting for. The other people who were getting incensed about the possibility, and it was looking like it was a possibility that Sinclair could actually win the governor's run, were people in Hollywood. And Hollywood was concerned that a left-leaning Democrat might actually try to socialize Tinseltown. So Hollywood essentially organized itself quite well, and what they created were what we can call fake newsreels, most famous of which was a shot of a bunch of hobos coming off of trains. And the idea was this would be the future of California if you voted Upton Sinclair as governor, because he's going to create all these collective enterprises in the state of California that's going to create an influx of poor people who are going to be moving to California, and it's going to be horrific, and there's no chance on earth that we really want this guy to be governor.
He wasn't swift-boated. He was boxcarred.
Yeah, he was newsreeled out of the governorship in some ways because these things were seen by large numbers of people, and they reached the sort of people who, for instance, may not be picking up their latest copy of the Los Angeles Times. And, you know, they seem to have scared a number of people away from voting for Sinclair.
Well, it's a jungle out there. You can do better than that. Give me a break here. Gee whiz.
I'm sorry, I'm not in my witty format as I usually am.
I'm not going to beg. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Kevin Mattson is a history professor at Ohio University. His book on Upton Sinclair is called Upton Sinclair and the Other American Century. He also has a new book out called What the Heck Are You Up To, Mr. President?, which takes a second look at Jimmy Carter's infamous malaise speech. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Sarah Fidelibus and Kasia Gladke, and edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. John Keefe is our executive producer, bassist, composer, Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone sends her regards from book writing hell. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.